We would like to send out a special thanks to Smithsonian Channel Plus for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Smithsonian Channel Plus is a new service that features original series and documentaries about crime and mystery, history, science, and pop culture, and more, including the new series called The Lost Tapes. So visit getscplus.com/cold and get 50% off your first 3 months of Smithsonian Channel Plus. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
July 2nd, 1966, Porter County, Indiana. 21-year-old Ann Miller, 19-year-old Patricia Blau, and 19-year-old Renee Brule leave their homes in Illinois in order to travel to the Indiana Dunes State Park. After taking a spot on the beach next to Lake Michigan, the three women vanish, leaving their belongings behind, and eyewitnesses would recall seeing them walk into the water and climb into a boat with an unidentified man. Over the years, there will be a number of theories about their disappearance, including a botched abortion and alleged ties to criminals from a horse syndicate. But no trace of the Indiana Dunes women is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we've got a baffling missing persons case to cover today. The 1966 disappearances of Ann Miller, Patricia Blau, and Renee Brule, a.k.a. the Indiana Dunes Women. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Kristen Ellen Thomas, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Kristen Ellen. This is a popular recurring monthly contest, which we have been carrying on for quite some time, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions at the end of this episode. Anyway, this is the baffling story of three female friends who decided to start off the long 4th of July weekend by spending the day at the beach in Indiana Dunes State Park, but even though there were thousands of other people around, they somehow vanished without a trace and left all their belongings and their vehicle behind. The most promising lead was an eyewitness sighting of the three women climbing into a boat with an unidentified man, but to this day, no one knows who this man was or why the women would have joined him. The reason I'm covering this case now is because it was nearly 7 years ago when I published my first article for listfirst.com, 10 Mysterious Disappearances of Multiple People, which pretty much set me down the path to eventually starting The Trail Went Cold. Looking back at the cases featured on that list, I was surprised to see that most of them have either wound up being solved or covered on this podcast, but this is the one I still haven't tackled yet. Given that it involved three women going missing at the same time, this case has received surprisingly little media coverage since it originally happened, but it's still heavily discussed online and contains a number of interesting theories which I will be talking about on this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the bizarre disappearance of the Indiana Dunes women. Our story begins in 1966 and involves three victims who would become known as the Indiana Dunes Women: 21-year-old Ann Miller, 19-year-old Renee Brule, and 19-year-old Patricia Blau, who usually goes by the name Patty. Anne currently lives with her family in the town of Lombard, Illinois, and makes her living by exercising horses at the Oak Brook Polo Club. It was their shared love of horses that allowed these women to become friends in the first place, as Anne and Patty originally met while boarding horses at the same stable, and Renee became their mutual friend because she and Patty were high school classmates. Even though they all lived in Illinois, the three friends decided they wanted to start off the long 4th of July weekend by traveling nearly 60 miles to Indiana Dune State Park. The 2,200-acre park was located in Porter County, Indiana, and ran along the southern shore of Lake Michigan. Anne and Patty had traveled to the park the previous weekend and liked it so much that they wanted to return there with Renee. At around 8 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, July the 2nd, Anne left her home in her 1955 Buick and went to pick up Patty, who lived with her family in the nearby town of Westchester, and told her mother that she was planning to return by the early evening. The two friends then traveled to the west side of Chicago to pick up Renee, who was living with her 21-year-old husband, Jeffrey Bruhl. The couple had been married for 15 months, and Jeffrey was attending college as an accounting student, and Renee wanted to get home in good time in order to prepare dinner for him. After stopping at a drugstore to pick up a bottle of suntan lotion, the three friends crossed over the state line into Indiana and drove to the park. They arrived in the parking lot at around 10 a.m., before hiking 3/4 of a mile to a spot on the crowded beach. On this particular day, it was estimated that around 8,600 people were frequenting the park, but the women would find a spot on the beach approximately 100 yards from the shoreline of Lake Michigan and spread their beach blanket on the side of a dune. A couple lying on the beach right next to them would distinctly remember the three women and play a pivotal role in this case. According to the couple, sometime around noon, Anne, Patty, and Renee entered the water and soon approached a white boat, which they described as being around 14 to 16 feet long and having a blue interior and an outboard motor. The boat was being piloted by an unidentified man who appeared to be in his early 20s and had a tan complexion and dark wavy hair. The women spoke to this man and climbed on board the boat before it headed west. At around 5:30 p.m., the couple realized that the three women had not been seen for several hours, but noticed that all of their belongings were still on their beach blanket, which included clothing, shoes, sunglasses, cigarettes, Anne's car keys, Patty's wallet, and Renee's purse, which contained $55 worth of checks. The couple decided to gather all of the belongings and take them to the park superintendent's office so he could hold on to the items in case the women came looking for them. Well, they would remain unclaimed for the next 2 days until the superintendent received a phone call from Patty's father. Sure enough, Patty, Anne, and Renee had not returned home on the evening of July the 2nd, and their families officially filed missing persons reports the following night. Patty's father wanted to know if the women had been seen at the park, and the superintendent informed him that he had their personal belongings in his possession. This prompted the park rangers to perform a search for the women, and they would eventually come across Anne's Buick in the parking lot, which was a match to the car keys left behind on the beach. Some additional belongings were still inside the vehicle, and all signs pointed to it having remained in the same spot for the past 2 days. This prompted the rangers to contact numerous law enforcement agencies, including the Indiana State Police and the United States Coast Guard, who would conduct extensive searches of the park and Lake Michigan. After the three women's disappearances were reported in the media, numerous eyewitnesses would come forward with reported sightings of them at the park over the weekend, but they often contradicted each other and could not be verified. Investigators believed that the sighting from the couple of the women boarding a boat with an unidentified man was the most credible, and it would be corroborated when an amateur photographer who had been filming home movies in the park on July 2nd came forward and handed over his reels to the police. When they viewed the footage, they were able to pick out what appeared to be three women and a man on a boat, which matched the couple's description. In fact, one of the women appeared to be wearing a yellow, ruffled bikini, the same type of bathing suit Patty had on when she disappeared. There would also be an additional compelling sighting of the three women, which took place at around 3 p.m., about a half mile east from the spot where they were last seen. According to a witness, a boat which he described as a 26 to 28 foot long Trojan cabin cruiser equipped with a radio or telephone antenna, came up to the beach with three men on board. One of the men approached the women and spoke to them before they accompanied him onto the boat and it left the area. This led to speculation that one of these men may have been the same guy seen on the smaller blue and white boat, and that after dropping the women off, he returned to the beach in another boat with two male companions in order to pick them up again. The problem is that there had been an estimated 5,000 to 6,000 boats on that stretch of Lake Michigan on July the 2nd, so the authorities had no success at tracking down the blue and white boat or the cabin cruiser. The families of the three missing women would state that they cannot think of any people in their lives who owned a boat matching either of those descriptions. On July the 2nd, debris from a boat would be discovered on Lake Michigan near a generating station, about 3 miles from where the women were last seen, but there did not appear to be any reports of missing boats or wrecks during that time period. While investigators explored the possibility that Anne, Patty, and Renee had been the victims of an accidental drowning, the theory was deemed unlikely, since all three women were considered to be fair to excellent swimmers. But a surprising discovery inside Renee's purse would lead some people to wonder if they had staged her disappearance. A note was found that Renee had written to her husband Jeffrey, in which she asked him for a divorce, complaining that he spent too much of his spare time working on cars with his friends, rather than spending time with her. However, both Jeffrey and Renee's family maintained that there were not any serious problems in the marriage. Since the note was dated 2 weeks before she disappeared, they believe that Renee may have written it in a moment of anger, but decided not to give it to her husband after she cooled down, and simply stuck it inside her purse and forgot about it. But a check into Patty's background would lead to a new theory about the disappearances. Like I mentioned earlier, Patty was passionate about horses, and even owned a thoroughbred named Hank, who actually won a few races in the weeks prior to her disappearance. A few months before she went missing, Patty suffered a facial injury, which looked like it might have been caused by a fist. When asked by friends and family what happened, Patty only replied that she had some problems with the quote-unquote horse syndicate people. Well, Patty, Anne, and Renee all rode and boarded horses at Tricolor Stables in the Palatine suburb of Chicago. The stables were run by a man named George Jane, whose half-brother, Silas Jane, ran an organized gang of criminals known as the Horse Syndicate. They earned that nickname because they often used the buying, selling, and betting of racehorses as a front for their criminal activities, and often did heinous things such as murdering their own horses in order to collect the insurance money. In June of 1965, a 22-year-old woman named Sherry Rood was killed in a car bombing at the Tricolor Stables. The car belonged to George Jane, who had asked Rood to move the vehicle for him, so it seemed like the bomb was intended for him. The prime suspect turned out to be Silas Jane, as the two half-brothers often got into heated disputes. In March of 1966, Silas was charged with conspiracy to commit murder following a sting operation in which Silas met up with an alleged hitman wearing a wire. Silas gave the man a down payment and was recorded saying, "It's time to buy a horse," which was supposedly a code for ordering him to kill George. But when Silas went on trial, and this hitman took the witness stand, he testified that he had suddenly developed amnesia, and stated, quote, "I can't even remember what I had for breakfast this morning. I'm sick," end quote. The witness refused to implicate Silas in the crime, so he wound up being acquitted. But in October of 1970, an attempt on George's life finally succeeded when he was shot to death through his basement window while playing bridge with his family. Less than 3 years later, Silas and four of his crew members were charged for the roles in George's murder. One of them agreed to testify against the others in exchange for immunity, and Silas was convicted of conspiracy to commit murder and received a sentence of 6 to 20 years. He was released from prison in 1979 and died of leukemia 8 years later. Anyway, investigators looked into possible connections between the horse syndicate and the three missing women, as the phone numbers for both George and Silas's wife, Martha, were found in their personal possessions. Since they often spent time at Tricolor Stables, a theory was pushed forward that the women may have witnessed the bomb being planted in George's car and were made to disappear because they knew something about the crime. It would not be until 1999, 12 years after Silas's death, when a man named James Blaudio was convicted of Sherry Rood's murder. He received a prison sentence of 100 to 300 years, and testimony at the trial would indicate that Silas had paid Blaudio to plant the bomb with the intention of killing George. Following the three women's disappearances, George was questioned by police, and while he acknowledged that he knew them, he had no information to offer. However, when George's murder was investigated years later, authorities would learn that during a trip to El Reno, Oklahoma, Silas had once made a remark to the local sheriff about three bodies being buried under his house. A search was reportedly planned for Silas's property, but the sheriff was killed in a tractor accident on his farm, and the search never took place. In the end, there was just no conclusive evidence to link Silas Jane or the horse syndicate to the disappearances. Investigators also looked into a former boyfriend of Patty's named John Paul Jones, who worked as a rodeo cowboy and had also spent time in prison. Jones had previously lived in the town of Hodgkins, Illinois, and moved to California only 2 weeks before the women went missing. A letter that Patty had written to Jones was found in her possessions, where she expressed her disappointment that he had left without telling her. Jones was questioned on two separate occasions, but he denied any knowledge or involvement in Patty's disappearance. The three women often met up at a tavern in Jones's former hometown of Hodgkins, and since Anne and Patty were both single, there were rumors that they had become involved with other men there. Dick Wiley was a crime reporter and photographer from the Chicago Sun-Times who covered this case and eventually went into law enforcement, and he would spend the next several decades doing his own independent investigation into the disappearances. Wiley would eventually reveal that shortly before she went missing, Anne had told some of her friends that she was 3 months pregnant and considering entering a home for unwed mothers. According to Wiley, Anne and Patty had been carrying on affairs with married men, and Patty may have become pregnant as well. On the night before they traveled to the park, both women apparently stayed out really late and did not get home until the wee hours of the morning. Wiley suspects that the unidentified man seen in the boat was Ralph Largo Jr., who lived in Gary, Indiana with his aunt and uncle, Helen and Frank Largo. It was rumored that the Largos ran an operation performing illegal abortions on their houseboat in Lake Michigan. Wiley suspects that this was the reason Ralph picked up the three women, but something went horribly wrong during the abortion, such as one of the women dying from complications, and the other two being killed because they were witnesses. But this only remains a theory, and thus far, no corroborating evidence has ever been presented to support it. So after 5 decades, no trace of Ann Miller, Patricia Blau, or Renee Brule has ever been found, and the Indiana Dunes women continue to remain missing persons. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our new sponsor, Smithsonian Channel Plus, as we are very excited that they have chosen to support The Trail Went Cold. Smithsonian Channel Plus is a new service that features original series and documentaries about crime and mystery, history, science, and pop culture, and more. And one of the new series they have, which should be of particular interest to true crime fans, is The Lost Tapes, a riveting non-fiction series where you can find stories such as the infamous manhunt for the Son of Sam, the capture of the 2002 DC Sniper, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, and so much more. The episodes feature rare radio broadcasts, classified government documents, archival imagery, and on-the-ground news reports, which allow shocking events from the 20th century to feel immediate again. And Smithsonian Channel Plus programming is also fact-checked for accuracy by experts at the Smithsonian Institution. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, I'd say there's a good chance you're already quite familiar with the Son of Sam case and might be wondering if another episode about that story could offer anything new. But that's the genius of The Lost Tapes. This isn't your standard true crime show featuring a narrator, reenactments, and recent interviews with talking heads. It consists entirely of archival material, such as original interviews and news broadcasts from the time period the murders took place, so you almost feel like you've traveled back to 1976 and 77 and are watching the events unfold in real time. Even if you think you know the Son of Sam case front to back, I guarantee that the Lost Tapes episode is going to contain footage you've never seen before, which is why I found it incredibly riveting to watch. So if you would like to view this episode, and many others just like it, be sure to visit getscplus.com/cold and get 50% off your first 3 months of Smithsonian Channel Plus. That's getscplus.com/cold to get 50% off your first 3 months. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. Now, like I mentioned in the intro, this was originally featured in a ListFirst article I wrote about cases where multiple people disappeared at the same time, and I definitely have a fascination with stories like that. I've covered other cases on the podcast in which three females disappeared simultaneously, such as the Fort Worth Three and the Springfield Three, but this one is particularly bizarre. The victims in the Fort Worth Three case seemed to disappear from a shopping center, whereas the Springfield Three vanished from their house in the middle of the night, but the Indiana Dunes women somehow managed to go missing from a crowded beach in broad daylight, in which there were hundreds, if not thousands, of other people around. All we really have to go on is the eyewitness account of the three women supposedly stepping into the water and climbing onto a boat with an unidentified male. Whenever I cover missing persons cases, I always make it a point to mention that eyewitnesses can often be mistaken about who they saw, but it seems like investigators always found this particular sighting to be credible, since the couple in question had been next to the women on the beach and were keeping an eye on them. And really, boarding a boat is the only explanation which makes sense, as all of their personal belongings were left behind. I mean, it seems like they did not have anything with them except the bathing suits they were wearing. I think it's particularly important to note that they didn't even take their shoes with them, which suggests they did not walk off anywhere. Since it's highly unlikely that someone could have abducted three women from a crowded beach without anyone seeing anything, you have to think they did board that boat. This theory is also supported by the fact that someone just happened to be filming home movies in the park that day and captured footage of a boat containing a man and three women, one of whom appeared to be wearing the same yellow bikini that Patty had on. I'm guessing that this footage is still being kept as evidence by the police, but if it was ever released publicly or uploaded to YouTube, I'm sure it would be incredibly eerie to watch, since it may very well have captured some of these victims' last moments alive. Whoever that man on the boat was, it's reasonable to assume he was somehow responsible for the disappearances, but the circumstances of how they wound up with them are very strange. I mean, since they had no qualms about leaving everything on the beach, including money, it seems like the women only planned to be gone for a short period of time. But unless they knew this man and had already made arrangements to meet him, what could have compelled them to board that boat? Well, looking back at the original news coverage of this case, it seems like the lead detective, Edward Burke, leaned towards this being a voluntary disappearance, but I just don't see it. I get the impression that Burke's opinion may have been influenced by the discovery of the note inside Renee's purse in which she told her husband Jeffrey that she wanted a divorce. Both Jeffrey and Renee's family maintained that any problems they may have been experiencing in their marriage were not serious enough to compel her to run away, and I think the fact that the note was dated 2 weeks beforehand is a strong indicator that it was just a red herring. I actually believe the explanation that Renee may have written the note in the heat of the moment because she was angry, but after she calmed down, she ultimately decided not to give the note to Jeffrey, so she put it into her purse and completely forgot about it for the next 2 weeks. I think that if Renee had really been planning to leave Jeffrey that day, she would have left the note at home. Yes, I suppose she could have staged her disappearance and intended for the note to be found inside her purse, but this was a crowded beach, and there's no guarantee that someone wouldn't have stolen the purse before it was discovered. In fact, if the couple who saw the women boarding the boat hadn't been such good Samaritans and decided to turn all the personal belongings into the park superintendent's office, who knows how long they would have remained at that spot before someone came along and stole them. Again, These three women literally had nothing on them but their bathing suits the last time they were seen, so I don't see how the idea of them running away is even plausible. Of course, another theory is that they drowned or got in some sort of boating accident, and their bodies were never found. I know many people wrote off the drowning theory because the women were very strong swimmers, but there are so many things which can go wrong when you're out on a body of water as vast as Lake Michigan. Incidentally, many of the sources state that Patty could swim 20 to 30 miles, but I think that's either inaccurate or an exaggeration. Let's put it this way. The English Channel is 21 miles wide, and swimming it was something only a handful of people had done at that time. So if Patty was really capable of that, then this would have placed her among some of the top marathon swimmers in the world. The boating accident theory is interesting, because debris from an apparent boat wreck was found about 3 miles away from the beach. It could not be matched up with any missing boats from the area. However, looking back at some of the original newspaper articles about the case, I read that the Coast Guard apparently determined that the debris had been in the water at least 3 weeks before it was found, and likely belonged to a small metal rowboat. I'm not exactly sure how they determined that, but if they're accurate, this would definitely rule out the possibility of the debris being connected to the case. Of course, this doesn't preclude the idea of a boating accident taking place at another location, but an extensive search of Lake Michigan turned up no other debris. I still believe the most logical explanation is that the man on the boat is responsible for what happened, but who could he have been? Well, if you go through online discussions of this case, you'll see some people place significance on the fact that one of the most horrific crimes in the history of the Midwest occurred only 2 weeks later. In fact, I think one of the main reasons the disappearances did not receive as much media coverage as they should have is because this crime wound up pushing it out of the headlines. On the evening of July 13th, 24-year-old Richard Speck broke into a Chicago townhouse which was functioning as a dormitory for student nurses, and over the course of the next several hours, he brutally murdered 8 young women. Speck was quickly captured, convicted of the murders, and sentenced to death, though his death sentence would be overturned, and he died in prison of a fatal heart attack in 1991. Now, if a person was brazen enough to single-handedly murder 8 women in one night, then you can certainly believe he was capable of killing 3 women at the same time, and if Speck was responsible for the disappearances of the Indiana Dunes women, perhaps it was his practice run for something much bigger. Well, according to newspaper articles from that time, Speck was questioned about the disappearances following his arrest, but investigators couldn't find anything to link him to the case. Indeed, Speck does not really match the description of the man on the boat, as he did not have dark, wavy hair. During this time period, Speck was staying in Chicago with his sister and her family, but he did not have his own transportation and relied on them to drive him around, so I don't see how he would have been able to make a 60-mile journey to Indiana Dunes State Park and gain access to a boat. So I think you can pretty much rule out Speck as having any involvement in the crime. However, there's another infamous criminal who is closely linked to this case, and that's Silas Jane. I could probably devote an entire podcast to discussing this guy and his infamous horse syndicate, but let's just say he was pretty much evil incarnate. I already talked about how he spent time in prison for arranging the murder of his half-brother, George, and when he went on trial for this crime in 1973, Silas had attained so much notoriety that he hired one of the most famous defense attorneys in the country, F. Lee Bailey, to represent him. All things considered, Silas is incredibly lucky that he did not serve more time in prison and was a free man when he died, because in the years following his passing, it seemed like more and more crimes wound up getting linked to him. I previously mentioned that the man hired by Silas to perform the car bombing, which killed Sherry Rood, was not convicted of that crime until 1999, but that's not all. In 1995, a child predator named Kenneth Hansen would be charged and convicted of the brutal murders of 3 young boys, 14-year-old Robert Peterson, 13-year-old John Schuessler, and his 11-year-old brother, Anton Schuessler Jr. The nude bodies of the 3 victims had been discovered in a ditch 40 years earlier, and it turned out that Hansen worked for Silas Jane at his horse stables and the murders took place inside a barn on his property. When Silas found out about it, he had the bodies moved into the ditch, where they were ultimately found. Silas has also been looked at as having potential involvement in two other infamous unsolved cold cases from the Midwest: the 1956 murders of 15-year-old Barbara Grimes and her 12-year-old sister, Patricia Grimes, and the 1977 disappearance of 65-year-old candy heiress Helen Brock. But I won't delve too much into those cases, because I hope to explore them individually on future episodes of this podcast. So the main connection which can be made between the Indiana Dunes women and Silas Jane and the Horse Syndicate is the fact that all three victims rode and boarded horses at Tricolor Stables, which was owned by George Jane. We know at the very least that Patty was personally acquainted with George, since she had his phone number in her possession, but while she also had the number for Silas's wife, it's unclear how well any of these women were acquainted with Silas himself. But since Patty suffered a facial injury a few months before she went missing, and claimed she had trouble with the quote-unquote Horse Syndicate people, it's tempting to believe they could be responsible for the disappearances. Silas also allegedly made a remark about having three bodies buried underneath his house, but no one knows if he was referring to these three victims, or if the remark was nothing more than a joke. Well, interestingly enough, if you go to the Web Sleuths forum, you'll find a lengthy thread about this case, containing a number of comments from Patty's younger brother, Robert Blau, who goes under the username Rob2014. Now, Web Sleuths apparently has a process in which their administrators verify people who claim they are personally connected to these crimes before they let them post, so I have no reason to believe that Robert's comments are not legitimate. I mentioned that Anne and Patty made a previous trip to Indiana Dunes State Park on the weekend before they went missing, but according to Robert, Patty had asked him if he wanted to go as well. Robert said yes, but the two women apparently left early that morning without telling him. When Robert confronted his sister about this, she apparently replied, quote, "You wouldn't have wanted to come. We met guys there." Robert also recounted an incident from a few days before Patty went missing, where she said she was making out a will and would leave her beloved thoroughbred Hank to him. Naturally, Robert found it surprising that his 19-year-old sister would be writing a will in the first place, and later that same day, Patty told Robert she had something important to tell him, which he could not share with anyone, but in the end, Patty ultimately decided not to say anything. From his comments, it's apparent that Robert believes that Silas Jane was somehow involved in his sister's disappearance. Of course, there's no way that Silas himself was the unidentified man seen on the boat, since he would have been nearly 60 years old at that point, and it was his practice to hire people to commit murder for him rather than do it on his own. Robert directed particular suspicion towards a known associate of Silas, who matched the physical description of the mysterious man and apparently owned a similar-looking blue-and-white powerboat, which he kept in the Indiana Dunes area. In fact, the story goes that shortly after the disappearances, this man made an insurance claim on his boat because it was supposedly destroyed in a fire. Well, if Silas was behind the whole thing, what motive would he have had to murder these three women? Well, I personally don't believe the theory that they were killed because they witnessed or had knowledge about the car bombing which killed Cherry Rude, as that incident took place over a year earlier. I will admit that it is interesting that Silas went on trial for another alleged plot to kill his half-brother shortly before they went missing. Even though Silas was acquitted, that was technically a different crime, so he still could have been charged for his role in the car bombing at a later time. But if these women knew anything about it, I don't see why Silas would wait an entire year before taking care of them. However, if Robert's comments about his sister are true, then she could have been murdered for other reasons. Patty's thoroughbred, Hank, had actually recently won two horse races, but Patty disappeared before she had a chance to collect the winnings. I'm not saying that played a role in her disappearance, but perhaps Patty was more immersed in the horse racing world than she let on, and got herself involved in something illegal connected to the syndicate. My biggest issue with the idea of Silas being responsible for the disappearance is that he was based in Chicago, so unless the three women were being followed, I'm not entirely sure how he could have known they would be on the beach at Indiana Dunes State Park on that particular day. And it seems weird that an organized crime figure would arrange to murder three women by having them picked up in a boat at a crowded public beach where the perpetrator could be seen by several witnesses. But I do find it intriguing how Patty apparently told Robert that she and Anne met guys at the park the previous weekend, so she could have made arrangements to meet those guys there the following Saturday. If they knew the man on the boat from a previous occasion, then that might explain why they walked into the water and climbed onto the boat without hesitation. Of course, if Anne and Patty were meeting up with guys they knew, I'm not sure why they would have chosen to bring Renee along with them, since she was a married woman, but then again, the note in Renee's purse seemed to indicate that things were not great with her husband, so perhaps she was looking for an extramarital fling. The real wild card in this case is the alleged sighting of the three women walking down a different section of the beach at around 3 p.m. that afternoon, where they supposedly boarded a larger cabin cruiser with three men. I know there's been speculation that the man from the smaller boat might have dropped the women off and returned with a larger boat and two other male companions to pick them up again. I suppose that's possible, as it would be a lot easier for three perpetrators to get rid of three victims rather than just one, but if this is what happened, it is odd that the women would not go back to collect or check on their belongings, especially after being away from them for hours. I know the 3 p.m. sighting was never officially confirmed as being the Indiana Dunes women, so I think there's a good chance that this eyewitness was mistaken and saw three completely different women boarding the cabin cruiser. After all, there were around 8,600 people in the park that day. So the other big major theory which has been pushed forward on this case is that the disappearance was the result of a botched abortion. Yes, I realize that after covering the Jean Spangler disappearance, this is my second episode this month about a missing persons case involving an abortion gone wrong theory, but we are talking about the pre-Roe vs. Wade era when abortions were still illegal and women would go to extreme lengths to terminate unwanted pregnancies. But the problem is that three women went missing in this particular case, and since I have my doubts that all three of them were pregnant, this means that if one of the women died due to complications from an abortion gone wrong, whoever was responsible had to make the calculated decision to flat-out murder the others in order to cover the whole thing up. I mean, I'm not saying it's implausible that something like that could happen, but there are many other issues with the abortion theory. The main proponent of it is Dick Wiley, the former crime reporter who came to this conclusion after performing several decades' worth of independent research into this case. During one of his interviews, Wiley claimed that he wrote a 120,000-word manuscript about his findings, which he was hoping to turn into a book. Unfortunately, this has yet to come to fruition, because I would certainly love to know more specific details about how Wiley reached this conclusion. All we know is that the three women spent a lot of time hanging out at this one particular tavern in Hodgkins, Illinois, where Anne and Patty allegedly became involved in affairs with married men, which led to one or both of them becoming pregnant. It seems like the primary evidence to support this theory is that Anne supposedly told some of her friends that she was 3 months pregnant shortly before she went missing, but the problem is that she also apparently said she was considering moving into a home for unwed mothers. Yeah, I'm sure you can see how that part would contradict the whole abortion theory. Sure, Anne could have changed her mind about having the child, but since abortion was still a very taboo subject back then, I think that most women would have been inclined not to tell anyone they were pregnant in the first place, unless they were absolutely certain of what they wanted to do. I'm also intrigued by the fact that John Paul Jones, a former boyfriend of Patty's who lived in Hodgkins, apparently moved to California without telling her only 2 weeks before she went missing. If he was in California at the time Patty disappeared, then I doubt Jones was involved, but I could see a scenario where he decided to take off because he got Patty pregnant, prompting her decision to get a secret abortion. Perhaps when Patty approached her brother and said she had something important to tell him, she was referring to an unplanned pregnancy rather than anything to do with the horse syndicate. Now, Dick Wiley theorizes that the man seen on the boat was Ralph Largo Jr., and that he picked up the women to take him to see his aunt and uncle, who supposedly ran an illegal abortion racket on their houseboat. Now, I tried to do some research on Frank and Helen Largo to see if there was any other information out there about this so-called floating abortion clinic, but the only sources I could find were in relation to this case. I know that Ralph Largo Jr. died in 2009, and I believe his aunt and uncle have also passed away. The only thing I could find online about this entire family was a blog about an incident in 1940 where Frank Largo went on trial on the charge of adultery and quote-unquote living off a prostitute's earnings, so Ralph Largo Sr. threatened a female witness into signing a statement which cleared his brother. Ralph Sr. later got involved in other criminal activity, such as safecracking, and apparently died in 1968. But even if the rumors about the Largo family operating an abortion racket on their houseboat are true, it really doesn't jive with the circumstances of how Anne, Patty, and Renee went missing. Remember, they walked into the water and climbed onto a boat wearing nothing but bathing suits, leaving everything behind on the beach. Given that abortions tend to cause a lot of bleeding, do you really think that any of these women would go through with a procedure like that without bringing any extra clothing, or even a towel or a beach blanket? And after the whole thing was done, were they just going to bring the women back to a crowded public beach and drop them off as if nothing had happened? It just seems to me that if one of them was going to go through with an illegal abortion, there would have been far less conspicuous ways to do so. The Largos apparently lived in Gary, Indiana, which was about 20 miles west of the park, so I really don't see the logic in stopping there and traveling the rest of the way by boat. I mean, if these women had told their families that they were planning to spend the day at the park and subsequently vanished without a trace, then yes, I could believe that the whole trip was just a cover story so that they could travel to Indiana to get a secret abortion. But their vehicle was found in the parking lot, their belongings were strewn all over the beach, and there were witnesses who saw them, so the women were definitely there. In fact, they were even seen purchasing suntan lotion before they left Chicago, which suggests that they planned for this to be nothing more than a routine, uneventful, relaxing day at the beach. And there's one key piece of information which is not mentioned in most of the accounts of this case. The only source where I have ever seen this is an article in the May 17th, 1970 edition of the New York Daily News, but it states that before leaving on the trip, Anne asked her younger sister if she wanted to come along, but she declined. And if this is accurate, then I think that blows a hole in the abortion theory. It doesn't say exactly how old Anne's sister was, but it's reasonable to assume that if she or one of her friends were getting an abortion, Anne never would have asked her to come along. In fact, the detail about the sister suggests that none of these women had anything secretive or nefarious planned that day. To make a comparison, in the Fort Worth 3 case, the youngest of the three victims, 9-year-old Julianne Mosley, only asked if she could accompany the two other girls to the shopping center at the very last minute. If they had been planning to run away or had something secretive planned, they probably never would have allowed Julianne to tag along, and I believe the same logic applies to Anne's younger sister. Overall, I'm not sure I completely believe the theories involving Silas Jane or a botched abortion, but I do think that the trip Anne and Patty took to the park the previous weekend might hold the key to the mystery. If Patty was telling the truth when she told her brother she met some guys there, I wonder if one of them was the wavy-haired man in the boat, and they had arranged to meet him on the beach that day. In fact, if Patty and Anne met multiple guys the previous weekend, then perhaps the sighting of them on the beach at 3 p.m. was accurate, and these were the two additional men seen in the cabin cruiser. Whatever the case, I do believe that something went horribly wrong, and all three women wound up dead shortly after boarding a boat that day. For all we know, the perpetrator or perpetrators could have been associated with Silas Jane, but I have a feeling that it might have been someone who has never popped up on the radar as a potential suspect. Whatever happened, the whole thing is still incredibly baffling, and I have to confess that even with all the information we have right now, there is no explanation which makes 100% complete sense to me. But I still would love there to be answers, So even though over 50 years have passed, if by chance you happen to have any information on the disappearances of Ann Miller, Patricia Blau, and Rene Brule, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Kristen Ellen Thomas for doing such a tremendous job at narrating the opening of this episode. If you've already entered our contest before, you are automatically eligible for my next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Once again, another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I decided to do a more lighthearted episode about my top 10 unsolved mysteries guilty pleasures, where I discuss some of the silliest segments the show ever produced, which still managed to be entertaining. And for our patrons in tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Lauren B. and Normika G. Thank you so much for your support. And we've got an important announcement to make. As I'm sure you're well aware, the coronavirus has become a big deal all over the world this past week, and since most people are going to be trapped indoors for the foreseeable future, we thought it would be a good idea to hold another live Watch Together event for our listeners. In case you're not aware, in the past, we have held marathons in which we've streamed unsolved mystery segments about the cases that were covered on The Trail Went Cold, so anyone is free to join us in our online streaming room in order to watch them and chat with us and your fellow fans. The event is being held this coming Saturday, March the 21st, at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The link to our screening room can be found in our show notes, and it's also pinned to the top of both our Facebook and Twitter pages, so all you have to do is click the link in order to join us. We hope everyone stays safe and healthy, and will join us on Saturday night. Anyway, I wanted to provide another reminder that for the second consecutive year, I will be attending the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Lowe's Hotel in Kansas City, Missouri, on the weekend of July the 11th to the 12th. If you would like to purchase tickets to that event, and haven't already done so, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and earn yourself a 10% discount by using the promo code TTWC. That's TTWC. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum, and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.